Samuel chapter 8. We're going to continue our study of 1 Samuel. I'm going to do a little bit of a recap, and then we're going to work our way through chapter 8, 1 Samuel chapter 8. Okay. Now, we've covered the first seven chapters. The first three chapters of 1 Samuel is about Samuel. It's about how did he come on the scene. And so we hear about his mom, who was a woman who was barren. She could not have children. And so she surrendered her desire to have a child for herself and offered herself to have a child for God. And God granted her a child. We have seen in those first three chapters the nurturing of Samuel as a small boy and God bringing him up to be a faithful priest in chapter 2, at the end of chapter 2. A faithful priest is described as this: someone who will do according to God's heart and mind. And let me just remind you that as a Christian, you are a priest. 1 Peter talks about the priesthood of all believers. And so a faithful priest looks like this: one who does according to God's heart and mind. We've seen chapters 1 through 3 is Samuel. Chapters 4 through 6, it's like the scene changes and Samuel just leaves the picture. And what becomes the central focus is the ark of the Lord. What happens is they encounter, the children of Israel encounter the Philistines. The battle does not go well. And so the leaders or the elders of the tribes decide that they should gather up the ark and bring it to the place of battle. In other words, what they really do is they treat God like a lucky charm. And the result is that there is the demise of an evil priesthood. Eli, the chief priest, and his two sons. Eli was a good man, but his sons were corrupt, and he did nothing about that. And so at the end of that battle, the priesthood is ended. They die. We've seen the glory of God demonstrated against idol worship as the Philistines captured the ark and took it among themselves, and the terrible results of that. We've seen the ark of the Lord return to Israel, but it is left in a shed on the back 40. In other words, it isn't a part of their central worship. It isn't a central piece of their worship for a long, long, not until David comes on the scene. And we've watched Samuel rise to power. This is now chapter 7. Chapters 4 through 6 are the ark. Chapter 7, we see Samuel come back in focus. His rise to power. He routs the Philistines and calls the Israelites back to faithfulness to God. And we ended last time with Samuel being the judge or the ruler. And quote unquote, chapter 7 ends with Samuel being the judge of all Israel. And that means everyone recognizes Samuel's God-given leadership. Okay. Now, as we begin chapter 8, you need to know that some time has passed. Some people think that 25 to 30 years have passed, and maybe more. Now, some scholars speculate that Samuel is in his 60s. And from this point on, in 1 Samuel, 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, and 1 and 2 Chronicles, what is going to be dealt with is kingship from this point on. Okay, so look at verse 1 with me. Chapter 8. It came about, now by the way, I'm reading from the New American Standard Version, which is not an easy version to read, but it really tries to work to be as literal as possible. And it came about when Samuel was old that he appointed his sons judges over Israel. Now, Samuel has gotten married, and he and his wife have had two sons who are now adults, and Samuel appoints them to leadership over the people. Now, we'll see in the next verse, the name of his firstborn was Joel, and the name of his second was Abijah. They were judging in Beersheba. Now, the map of Israel, where Samuel is that if you saw the country and you put your finger right in the middle of that map, that would be close to Ramah. That's where Samuel's at. If you go all the way to the south, the furthest south is Beersheba. So that's where his sons are in the south. Now, I'll also say, this is unprecedented. Judges were never appointed. God always raised up a judge. So this is something new. Okay. They are judges as he is, these two sons. They preside over justice issues and are to lead the people spiritually. That's what judges do. The job is to represent the Lord's perspective in legal problems and social concerns. Okay, so verse 2, you have his, their names, and then verse 3. His sons, however, did not walk in his ways, but turned aside after dishonest gain and took bribes and perverted justice. They are not honest men. They rule for their own benefit and advantages. And by the way, I'll say to you, when you encounter someone who's ruling for the kingdom of God, who has a leadership role in the kingdom of God, they always rule for the benefit of those who are under their rule. They never rule for their own benefit. When you encounter leadership, even if it's in the church, and that leadership is for its own benefit, that is not kingdom rulership. That's not kingdom leadership. These men rule for their own benefit and advantages. Now, we've already seen a leader of Israel have corrupt sons, and that ended in disaster. That was Eli and his two sons who were the corrupt priests. In verse 4, it says, then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah. Now, these are probably most likely the same elders that we read about in chapter 4 who decided that after they lost a major battle, that what they needed was the Ark of God. It was their lucky charm. And so they're the ones that brought the Ark to the battle, counting on it to be what turns the tide. And that ended very, very badly. And now look at verse 5. And they said to him, behold, you have grown old. I'll tell you what, if any of y'all say that to me, I'm going to punch you in the throat. Okay? Behold, you have grown old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint a king for us to judge us like all the nations. Now, I want you to look at the reasons. First of all, they say, this is brand new. This has never happened. Israel has never had a human king. The belief was that God was their king. And so this is a request. It will become a demand. But this is a request that's completely out of, I mean, it comes in sideways. Okay. Now, part of the reasons for making this request is that you have grown old. Now, what that means is that the security that they have enjoyed under Samuel, which in chapter 7 we're told that there was, that once Samuel took the judgeship, the leadership of the country, they had no more problems with the Philistines. They had peace and security. But now what's happening is that the security that they've enjoyed under Samuel is now becoming a question with his age. Insofar as the peace and the stability that they have had under Samuel and how much it depends on Samuel, it is now becoming jeopardized because he's getting older. Plus, another thing they've added is that Samuel's sons that he appointed to take his place are corrupt. In other words, their leadership is not like Samuel's. And the well-being of the people cannot be guaranteed by the son's leadership, so because they're corrupt. The peace and security and prosperity under Samuel was beginning to be threatened. And so what we hear in verse 5 is the people's solution. This is our solution. Appoint a king for us to judge us. But listen to these words that follow that. So that we can be like the other nations. Now, in this proposal, they're asking Samuel, who is their judge and ruler, to replace himself. Now, I don't know about you, but you know, if someone came up to me and said, Scott, we want you to appoint someone to start doing a hardcore Bible study, I'd be offended. I mean, you're asking me to replace myself. And they're asking Samuel to replace himself, not with another judge, but with a king who will judge the people. Now, this is probably part of the reason that the proposal offended Samuel. We hear that in the next verse, verse 6. But the thing was displeasing in the sight of Samuel. Now, that word really means evil. But there is a spiritual reason they make this proposal that is found in these words, so that we can be like other nations. They want to be like the other nations around them, rather than be the particular, unique people God had called them to be. In other words, when they allowed God to rule them, you know, the goal was to be able to show the world what God was like, because he was their king. But now the proposal is a rejection of trusting God for leadership of the people, and rejecting God, you know, rejecting to trust him to take care of them. Listen to verses 6 through 9. But the thing was displeasing to the sight of Samuel, in the sight of Samuel, when they said, give us a king to judge us. And Samuel prayed to the Lord. The Lord said to Samuel, listen to the voice of the people in regard to all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over them. Like all the deeds which they have done since the day that I brought them up from Egypt, even to this day, in that they have forsaken me and served other gods, so they are doing to you also. Now then, listen to their voice, however, you shall solemnly warn them and tell them of the procedure of the king who will reign over them. Their idea was good. It was a good idea. This is our proposal since you're getting old, Samuel. It was working for other nations, but it was not God's idea for them. Now, there's a big difference, beloved. There's a big difference between a good idea and God's idea. Don't ever think a good idea is good enough. If you want to be seeing the fruit of what it means to live with God and walk with God and follow him, then ideas need to start with him, not with you and not with others. This was not God's idea for them. In fact, it was a rejection of God's ways. You see, with a king, there would be no more need to depend on God to raise up a leader. Leadership would automatically pass from father to son in a monarchy. And what blows my mind about this is that they've already seen two good fathers, two good leaders, Eli and Samuel, who both had corrupt sons. You know, what would happen if those sons got into leadership is that they would lead the people to a place of strife and chaos, not peace and security. And what's really mind-blowing is that that is the exact system that they are wanting Samuel to set up, a father who then is succeeded by his son. Now, God isn't against them having a king. I mean, he was their king, but not to be like other nations. They don't want to be who God has made them to be. They want to be like the people around them. And in essence, they are saying to God, no thanks. We can now take care of ourselves. Now, notice in these verses, beloved, what is Samuel's first move? He listens to the people, and it says that he sees this as an evil thing, but what's his first thing that he does? Does he tweet how stupid the elders are? Is that what he does? No. Does he get on Facebook and talk about how unfair they're being to him? No. What Samuel does first, his first move is he prays. Now let me say, beloved, that praying is often the best first move. I'm going to say that again. Praying is often maybe all the time, but I'm going to say prayer is often the best first move. You know, what I do, and I know others do this as well, is that we try everything that we can think of first, and when that doesn't work, then we pray. But that's not Samuel. His first move is prayer. God responds to his prayers, and the response God gives is kind of shocking, really. I kind of expected God to say, you know, here's Samuel saying, oh, okay, they're asking this evil thing, God. What should I do? And I was expecting God to say, okay, I'm just done with it. I can't do this anymore. Pack up your family, Samuel, and move, because I'm about to make the place a parking lot. But instead, he says, no, Samuel, listen to the people. Wait, what? What? Samuel considered their proposal to be evil, but God is making clear to Samuel that the problem is not political, it's not governmental, but it's spiritual. They are rejecting God, not just Samuel. But before God gives the people what they want, he tells Samuel to solemnly, that means seriously, sternly, powerfully warn them. Now let me pause before I go on about the warning. Let me say to you, if you insist on your own way with God, at some point he'll let you have it. It's like listening to Jesus in the garden when he's praying to God to relieve him of having to go to the cross, but then he ends that prayer by saying, not my will, but yours. At some point with God, if you continue to insist on your own way, then at some point God will say to you, okay, not my will, but yours. And I'll tell you, that will always end badly. If you insist on your own way, and you continue to insist on your own way, God will give it to you. Now, God tells Samuel to sternly warn them. Now, this is an act of mercy, beloved. It's to give them a chance to change their minds. I mean, when we insist on our own way, that's a path that leads to nothing but death. Listen, I want you to get your app or your Bible in front of you, and I want you to read verses 10 through 18. And what you're looking for as you read 10 through 18 is you're counting how many times the word take is said, okay? Verses 10 through 18, how many times is the word take used? Okay, now, when I counted in my version, and I read it in several different versions, it was the same. But it was six times. Six times the word take is used in nine verses, okay? Now, what I want you to do, I want you to read the same verses again, verses 10 through 18. And now what I want you to look for, how many times the king gives back or contributes to the people. How many times? The answer is zero. Zero. You know, my version said in verse 9, it says, tell them of the procedure of the king. That word really means the custom or the practice or the habitual behavior of the king. And the practice or habitual behavior of the king will be to take. A king, like other nations, is parasitic, not giving. By the way, if you insist on your own way and you walk your own way, it will take from you. You may you may be seduced to think that it will give to you, but the end result is it will take dearly from you. The king will take and take and take, take property, take children, take freedom, and when everything is gone, you will be forced to serve. That's called slavery. It will be like the Exodus never happened for these people, except for one major difference. In Exodus 2, we are told that the people cried out and God heard their cries, but not this time. Look at verse 18. After there's all that taking, then you will cry out in that day because of your king whom you have chosen for yourselves, but the Lord will not answer you in that day. That's the one big difference. God will not listen to their cries. Now, beloved, think for a moment. What would it be like if God sent someone to you whom you know to be a person God speaks with? You know that. You know that him or her and God speak together regularly. And then they come to you and they say, if you continue on the course that you're on, God will not listen to your prayers anymore. What would that do to you? I mean, that would stop me in my tracks. But the warning to the people that Samuel gives to the people, it falls on deaf ears. I also want you to notice in verse 18, that my version said, and it's actually this way in the Hebrew, your king whom you have chosen for yourselves. The word you in Hebrew is there three times. It's emphasizing that this is all on them. This is your doing. When things become ugly, and they will, what God is saying is, remember that this is what you did. I didn't do it. Your king didn't do it. You did it. It's all on you. Now, what happens in verse 19, the request in verse 5, appoint us a king, it now becomes a demand. Listen to this verse 19 and 20. Nevertheless, the people refused to listen to the voice of Samuel, and they said, no, but there shall be a king over us, that we may also be like the nations, that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles. Notice the reason to be like other nations is repeated. It has become a firm intention that they themselves would become like the other nations. They want to become like the people around them, not the people that God has called them to be. But something new is added in this verse. It's that our king may go out before us and fight our battles. Now, beloved, that terminology is used elsewhere in Deuteronomy, in Judges, in 1 Samuel chapter 17, in 2 Chronicles, to describe God's role as the defender of Israel. So now, what they're saying is the battle is not God's anymore, it's ours. Our king can fight our battles. In other words, they're firing God and giving his job to a human king. What they don't realize is that they are rejecting the only form of security that will endure. How many times have we done that? Samuel repeats the people's words to the Lord. This would be, prayer for the purpose of hearing God's perspective on what the people are saying. And God, in essence, says back, do what they ask. And Samuel sends everyone home so he can begin the process. That's the end of the chapter. So what are some of the lessons here? I'm going to offer four ideas, four questions for you to ponder. And then y'all can work through these in your small group. But now your small group leader may have something else that has come up to them that they want you guys to help process and that sort of thing. Number one, this is it. Notice how Samuel makes praying a priority. It is his first response. Now, beloved, I'm going to say to you, I am not a person who has any kind of expertise in prayer. But I can confidently say that praying changes things in this world. If anything, prayer will change you. Your praying will change you. But prayer changes things in this world. This is hinted at in the very first chapter of 1 Samuel, where the idea of prayer, as he's coming into existence and on the scene, the idea of prayer is mentioned 6 times in that chapter, counting the first verse of chapter 2. We will see in 1 Samuel, as we go on further and study further, that praying plays a vital role in the events of God's people. Now, do I have this same attitude? Do I count prayer as vital? Do I make praying a priority? Now, most of us don't spend any significant time praying because we think we got it covered on our own. That perspective, beloved, leads to living more and more like all those who don't care to know God. In other words, you can get to the point as a Christian where your life looks no different than someone who's not a Christian. Samuel, who prayed, saw the evil in the people's request for a king. The people who don't pray, as far as we know, seem to not be aware that they were actually rejecting God in their actions. The lack of prayer contributed to a lack of perspective. I think that's very true. So how's your prayer life doing? If your prayer life was a sailboat, would you say that your praying is making progress? Or would you say that your praying is stalled and sitting still with no wind in your sails? Would you say that your prayer life is leaking out and needs bailing out and repair? Or would you say that your prayer life is at the bottom of the lake? Prayer needs to be a priority. But I want to add this real quick. Please know that when it comes to prayer, all of us are beginners. All of us. All of us struggle with prayer. All of us. The person who doesn't struggle with prayer is a very rare person. And my guess is that praying has something to do with their spiritual gift. But for the majority of us, prayer is a struggle. That's just part of the territory of praying. Don't give up because it's a struggle. All of us are beginners. How's your prayer life? Number 2. How is your dependency on the Lord doing? Is your dependence on Him growing, or are you looking for ways to lessen how much you need to depend on Him? You know, it takes courage to depend on God. And the more you depend on Him, the more you trust Him, the more courage it takes. Maybe I should be asking you, how's your courage doing? Courage to trust the Lord. The people in chapter 8 had become cowards and they wanted an easy way out. They didn't want to trust God anymore for what they needed. Are you doing that? Or are you becoming more and more courageous with trusting the Lord? Number 3, please notice that the plans of your own making, no matter how good they are, if God is not the source of the ideas, if you or someone else are the source, then those ideas and plans will cost you. And the longer you hold on to them, the more they will cost you. Any plan that does not come from Him will not have His life in it. And the ultimate result will be the death of something. Are you making plans for your life with God? Or are you making plans without Him? Seek to let the Lord inform you on the perspective of things like Samuel did. And number 4. Are you eliminating hurry from your life? Yeah, I'm talking to college students. Are you eliminating hurry from your life? Notice the people are saying, make us a king. And I don't know if you notice it or not, but it means now. In verse 5, that word is actually used, now. You feel the pressure of that? But Samuel dismisses them and waits for God to show him his next steps. The only time you should hurry, beloved, is when there is an emergency or God tells you to. Otherwise, you should be trying to ruthlessly eliminate hurry from your life. As far as I know, as far as I can tell, Jesus never hurried. And we are called to be like him. In 2005, I know which was, you know, centuries ago, but in 2005, the term hurry sickness was coined. It is the compulsive need to do more and to go faster. When hurried, we experience a phenomenon known as narrowing of the cognitive map. That is, we miss details. We are not fully present in the moment, and we don't make the best choices. Ruthlessly eliminate hurry from your life. Samuel did. I'll end with this story. Diana had a saying where she would say to someone that she was visiting with, and this person actually came to her because they were haggard and frazzled by life. And I heard her say this to many individuals. She would listen to their story, be very gentle and compassionate, encouraging them to tell her just how busy, how frazzled, how stretched they were. And then she would say this wouldn't be the only thing she would say, but then she would say these words to them: "I wish you slowness." So, beloved, may I wish you that this semester. I wish you slowness. Well, that's our lesson for tonight. How'd I do? Yes. Okay. Let's break up into our small groups. First of all, before we do that, would small group leaders stand up? Let's just make sure we know who our small group leaders are. There we go. Okay. Drew. Okay. Now, wherever they sit down, then y'all gather around. If you've been here before, then you know who your small group leader is. If you haven't been, then feel free to join any group. So, thank you.